Welcome to the Center Church Podcast. Glad you decided to listen in. In a typical week, we normally record live during our Sunday morning service here at Center Church in Spokane. But this week, we're in studio. We're mixing it up a little bit, still continuing our journey through the story, the high-level, big-picture narrative of the Bible. And so today, we're in chapter 17 of 31 chapters. And we've seen this pattern emerging over the last several weeks as we've covered about a 200 to 300 year span in the life of God's people, where they have this constant struggle with idols. They worship false gods. They keep coming back to it over and over, no matter how many times the true God demonstrates himself to them. And I had this really weird example in my own life that just made me think of how idols work. A few weeks ago, my wife and my daughter were gone, and so I was home alone with my two boys. One's in fifth grade, and one's in first grade. And when the girls are gone, we have bros night, and so we decided to make what we call man burgers. And those are basically the same as the burgers we would barbecue any other time, except with unreasonable amounts of bacon on them. So we went to the store. I was doing what I always do. I was shopping for the food and ignoring them while they're doing what they always do, continuously asking me, "Dad, can we get this? Dad, we need that. Dad, 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 dad," throwing things in the cart. This is sort of our routine. And we got what we needed. We headed home, and I started barbecuing the food. And after it was all ready, I brought it to the table, and we sat down. And my older son, he took a bite out of his burger. And then he just sat there and stared at it in bewildered disappointment. And he said to me, "Dad, is this turkey bacon?" And I said, well, yeah, it is. See, I'm a semi-health conscious person. I don't like to go crazy with my diet because I don't want to be held captive to it, and I don't want the people around me to be held captive to my own restrictive diet. Some of you have been there, and you know that that can be kind of a headache, but I just like to save it where I can, so I got turkey bacon. That didn't seem like an unreasonable thing to me. And my younger son said to me, "Dad, turkey bacon just makes me think of how awesome it would be if it was real bacon." Now, if I had had my wise spiritual head of household hat on, what I would have said was, "Well, son, isn't this a perfect example of how idols work in our lives? We think they'll fulfill us, but in the end, they just leave us empty." But since I didn't have that hat on, I said what any of us would have said. I said, "Shut up and be thankful." Not quite in that tone. But it really did make me think, what a good example of how we pursue things to make us happy, counterfeit things, they're not quite the real thing, and then in the end, they fall flat. They don't come through on their promises. This is what's been happening over and over in the story, in the life of God's people up to this point. They keep pursuing things beside God for fulfillment, but in the end, they end up disappointed. And quite often, they end up bitter. It's a pretty ugly cycle that they live in. Nonetheless, they continue in it. There's this tiny little sequence of letters at the end of the Bible written by John. John was the last surviving disciple, the last surviving apostle of Jesus' original 12 disciples. And he wrote this sequence of short letters. And at the end of 1 John, chapter 5, there's 21 verses. And the last two verses, this is what it says. "We know that the Son of God has come, and he has given us understanding so that we can know the true God. And now we live in fellowship with the true God because we live in fellowship with his Son, Jesus Christ. He is the only true God, and he is eternal life. Dear children, keep away from idols." It closes out the letter by saying, "Keep away from idols." I tend to think of idols as sort of an Old Testament problem, not really a modern problem. I'm going to go out on a limb right now and assume that no one listening to this recording has ever carved out a wooden idol and built a shrine to it and then worshiped it as God. I'm confident that none of us has ever done that. That's just weird. That's just goofy to me. But he says to them, centuries later, "Keep away from idols." Apparently, it was still going on. Thousands and thousands of years after it first started, it was still going on. And the truth is, it's still going on in our lives today. The New Living Translation of the Bible in that same verse says, "Dear children, keep away from anything that might take God's place in your hearts." And that's what idols do. They take God's place in our hearts. Day in and day out, we continually are bombarded by things that will drive us away from the blessed life God has for us because they so easily supplant God on the throne of our hearts. That's our problem with idols. That's what it looks like today. That could look like a lot of different things, but that's what it looks like today. So you might remember, if you've been following the story, it's been a few months ago now, we talked about the Ten Commandments. Even if you weren't following the story, you might have some familiarity. And the essence of the first two commandments is, number one, God says, "Have no other gods beside me. I alone am God. Acknowledge me alone as your God." And the second one is really just a paring down or kind of a narrowing of focus on the first commandment. It says, in essence, don't worship anything that I've created. Now, a rhetorical question you might ask yourself is, how much of everything that exists did God create? I said it was rhetorical, but I'm going to answer it anyway. The obvious answer is all of it, 100%. So if God said, don't worship anything that I have created, there's only one thing left to worship. There's only one thing that exists outside of the creative order, and that's God himself. These are the first two commandments. Don't worship anything beside me. Don't have any other God besides me. That's what God says. Martin Luther, who was the father of the Reformation, or at least one of them, he said this. He said essentially, it's impossible to break any commandment until after you've already broken the first two. It's impossible to disobey God in any way until after you've already taken God off the throne of your heart and put something else up there. So, for example, once you take God off the throne of your life, then you can steal. Once you take God off the throne of your life, he's not calling the shots, he's not uppermost in your affections anymore, then you can lie, then you can cheat. Once you've taken God off the throne of your life, then you can root for the Kansas City Chiefs. That's how it works. I don't know that that was one of the commandments, but we can't break anything, any of the commandments, or disobey God in any way until after we've already taken him off the throne of our hearts. And as humans, we can replace God with anything. You name it. Sex, material, wealth, celebrity, comfort, family, anything you can think of, we can replace God with it. Even things that are a little bit more abstract, we can replace God with things like worry, fear, comparing ourselves to others, coveting other people's circumstances or other people's possessions. There's basically nothing that we can't replace God with. There's nothing that can't become our idol if we're not careful. Tim Keller puts it this way. He said, "The true God of your heart is what your thoughts effortlessly go to when there is nothing else demanding your attention." Now that stings a little bit. Jesus summed up the principle this way in Matthew 6:21. He said, "Where your treasure is, the thing you treasure, the thing that's most important to you, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." That's the principle that Jesus is talking about. And so really what we see is that the essence isn't necessarily behavioral. The essence is rejecting what is false, choosing what is true. Reject the false and choose what is true. Because if we follow the false, we will eventually end up somewhere that we had no intention of going in the first place. So we're here in chapter 17. I'll give you the really brief clip notes up to this point. God's nation of Israel has been divided into two parts. There's a northern kingdom of Israel, a southern kingdom of Judah. And God keeps sending them prophets. He keeps sending men to tell them, "You're going the wrong way. This isn't going to end well for you. You're moving the wrong direction. Turn around and go back to God. Get rid of your idols and worship God." But they do what we often do. They're completely belligerent, and they reject everything that the prophets have to say. And eventually what happens is they're rebellious to the point where God removes his hand of protection. And the northern kingdom, Israel, is overrun by the Assyrian army. doesn't take very long. Assyria is a great power at this time. And so they're overrun. But the southern kingdom sees what's happening. And they have a great king at this time named Hezekiah. And Hezekiah says, listen, this is what's going to happen to us if we don't turn back to God. So he purges Judah, the southern kingdom, of their idols. They turn their hearts back to God. They repent. They confess. They ask God for forgiveness, and they worship him. And thus, the southern kingdom is preserved. God protects the southern kingdom from the Assyrians and actually wipes out the entire Assyrian army. So Judah, the southern kingdom, enters into a period of peace, prosperity. Things are good in the southern kingdom. And that's where we're at the moment. It's really an interesting story. Has the essential elements of a good story. You have good, God, you have evil, the false idols, and then you have a great dilemma. The people have to choose which direction they're going to go. And this week in chapter 17, if you've read it or if you plan to read it this week, you're going to find there's some pretty disturbing things in there. Now, some of you had no intention of reading it, but now that I said there's something disturbing in there, you're going to read it, and that's because you're sick. So enjoy. But under Hezekiah, Judah returned to God, and God does what he always does when we return to him. He takes them back immediately, no questions asked. But unfortunately, Hezekiah does what we all do. Eventually, he dies, and his son Manasseh takes over. His son Manasseh becomes king, and he is not a good king. 2 Kings 21:11 says, Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these detestable sins. He has done more evil than the Amorites who preceded him and has led Judah into sin with his idols. Manasseh is, out of all the horrible kings they've had in this time period, he is the worst. In fact, he saw God defend them. He knows about God wiping out the Assyrian army. He knows about the peace and prosperity that has existed under his father's reign. Nonetheless, he feels like it's better to worship false gods. In fact, he even sacrifices one of his own sons to a false god. So when I said, you know, he was kind of an idiot, I was actually being kind. Manasseh is a horrible king. And what ends up happening to Judah is God says, okay, I can see that you're not going to turn this around on your own. And God removes his hand of protection from them. Basically, he allows them to endure the consequences. So history and theology collide right here. The Assyrians are no longer in power. The Babylonians have risen to power, and they come in, overtake the southern kingdom. They destroy Judah. They destroy Jerusalem. They destroy the temple that Solomon had built. And in the year 586 BC, they take captive God's people. And God's people are dispersed really throughout the Babylonian Empire as slaves. But God does what he always does. He makes good on his promises. If you've been following the story, you have seen time and time again, God has said, I'm going to bless the entire earth through this family line, the family of Abraham, the Jews, the Israelites. God has maintained that promise. And so what he does right here is he sustains that promise through one prophet named Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah is an interesting case because in spite of all that's happened, Jeremiah continues to urge the people to turn back to God. Even though it really looks like the end of the kingdom, he continues to say, turn back to God. Get rid of your idols. God will turn this situation around if we'll just come to him. Stop worshiping idols. Stop racing toward the dead end. And this is what God says to Jeremiah in chapter 2, verse 9. He says, I bring these charges against my people again, declares the Lord. Has a nation ever changed its gods? But my people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. God asks his own rhetorical question. He says, who changes gods? Who does that? Even the nations that worship false gods don't change their gods. Why would my people exchange their glorious God for false idols, for worthless little statues and other such things? And it's a great question for us to ask ourselves. Because the truth is, we probably change gods all the time, depending on what our personal interest or enthusiasm is pointed towards in that moment. But then God goes on to explain his frustration. Jeremiah 2:13, God says, my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. And this imagery right here is really the big idea, the problem of cisterns. If you don't know what a cistern is, it is basically a hole in the ground that holds water. In this part of the world, there's not a lot of rain. There's a rainy season and a dry season. And so what they do is they dig these huge holes and let them fill up with water during the rainy season so that they'll have something to live on the rest of the year. And, you know, it is what it sounds like. It's a hole in the ground, very rocky, sandy ground. And the water that's in them is not pure, clean water like we have coming out of our tap. A cistern is basically a small retention pond. So if you've ever seen a retention pond in the middle of August, they're pretty nasty. There's a lot of stuff growing in there. The water's always dirty. This is how they get their water, out of these retention ponds, these cisterns. There's no inflow or outflow. It's just stagnant, slimy, dirty water. It's pretty nasty. It's pretty gross, but it will sustain life. You can get by on it. But what makes their situation really ridiculous is that they're digging these cisterns, which, by the way, was no small chore, in this rocky soil. You know, they didn't go rent a backhoe. They didn't even have what we would consider to be a good shovel. For some people, their entire life just revolved around trying to collect water. That's how they spent their lives. This was no small task. And then when they did get the hole dug, the water that was in them was horribly disgusting. You can look it up. You can Google it. You'll see pictures of it. But quite often, after they went to all the effort of digging it, they leaked. They didn't even hold that much water. And so what was left in the bottom was just awful, disgusting. What makes the whole situation completely ridiculous is that God is saying, there's a spring of water, a spring of living water right here, right in front of them, and yet they choose to dig the cisterns that don't hold water, do all that work, and then drink the nasty water after the fact. That's the cycle they live in, when all they have to do is turn around and there's a spring of living water right there. It's great imagery. And the analogy of the water is great because dirty water can sustain life. It's not pretty, it's not enjoyable, but you can get through life digging holes and drinking dirty water. Yes, you'll be miserable, but you can get by that way. And that's what we do in life. We get by. We get in the machine, we get in the cycle, we got bills to pay, we got kids to take care of, we have all these things that we need to do that are just part of our cycle, and we spend our lives just maintaining the machine. Just maintaining the cycle, chasing the elusive thing that will make the cycle that much more enjoyable. And that idol changes from one day to the next. Today we're hoping to get this, tomorrow we're hoping to get that. And we spend our lives chasing these idols that never complete us, that never add meaning to our lives in the end. And the Bible describes our life as a vapor. This life, this blip in time that we have, is unbelievably short. And we spend so much of it just maintaining the machine. And that's exactly what God's people are doing. They're just in this cycle. They're continually seeking their fulfillment in things that cannot deliver it, that cannot come through on their promises. And my fear for us is that we spend way too much of our limited short lifetime just getting by and sustaining the machine, when all the while God's invitation is, turn around, there's a spring of living water right here. Come, thrive. Come to me. I can sustain it. I can handle being your God. But we can so easily just be distracted maintaining the machine, and we just keep following the prompts from one day to the next, and eventually we end up somewhere that we just had no intention of going in the first place. So for centuries now, God has been pointing his people down a particular path, and at times they manage to stay on that path and things go pretty well. One of the things that I find interesting is that whether they're on the path or they're not, God's message really doesn't change. Through all the ups and downs, he continues to say, follow me and I will lead you to life and blessing. It's a formula as old as time. Let God be God, you be you. Let him plot the course and he will lead you to full life. And in Jeremiah 6:16, we find some really useful, practical, touchable instruction. And I think this is just a central verse to this entire chapter 17. I hope you'll read it. If you're not familiar with the story, you can hit our website and go to the story page. At the bottom of the page, there's links to get your hands on that. But this is what it says in Jeremiah 6:16. This is what the Lord says. Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. The New Living Translation says, stop at the crossroads and look around. Ask for the old godly way and walk in it. Travel its path and you will find rest for your soul. Stop at the crossroads and look. Count the cost. Consider carefully the choices that are before you, and consider carefully where each of the paths is ultimately going to lead, and then ask for the old godly way and walk in it. You don't have to chase after new formulas to try and find happiness. You don't have to jump from one thing to the next. God's message has never wavered. Travel its path and you will find rest for your souls. Follow me and I will give you peace. It sounds so familiar to something that Jesus said 600 years later in Matthew 11:28. Jesus said, come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, let me teach you, because I am humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. It doesn't matter how well things are going for you right now or how poorly things are going for you, there are burdens in your life that God would love to carry for you. In fact, he's offering to carry them for you. He's simply saying, turn around, I'm right here. I will carry them for you. That's what I want to do. I want to be your God. Offload all of those other things on me, and you will find rest for your souls. Even Peter, who followed Jesus, who walked with Jesus personally, this is what he said in 1 Peter 5:6. He said, humble yourselves under the mighty power of God, and at the right time, he will lift you up. Give all your worries and cares to God because he cares about you. Because God cares for you. Ultimately, I want to invite you to cast your cares upon him, to give your cares over to Christ. Because we've all experienced what it's like to chase one thing and then another and bounce from one thing to the next and one goal to the next, and then we achieve the goal, and what happens? We just find a new goal to chase. This is the cycle that we so often live in. C.S. Lewis likened God creating man to a man creating a gasoline car, an engine. He said, a gasoline engine will run only on gasoline. It can't run on anything else. Likewise, God can't give us happiness apart from himself because our soul is meant to feed on him. He is the fuel for our souls. It won't run properly on anything else. And he can't give us happiness outside of himself because it simply doesn't exist. So I want to encourage you today, cast your cares on God. Let your soul feed on him. Return from the things that have dethroned God or supplanted him on the throne of your hearts. Cast those cares on him. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week. God bless you.